Take a network break. Welcome to episode 36. Grab a coffee, a donut, and then join us for an analysis of the latest IT news, vendor moves, and new product announcements. We'll separate the signal from the noise, or at least make some noise of our own. I'm Drew Connery Murray, and with me as always is Greg Farrow and Ethan Banks, and let's dive into this week's news.
Drew, before we jump into the rest of the news, just very quickly wanted to thank today's sponsor for the show, which is Viptela, who is a software-defined WAN company who are producing overlay WAN technology that gives you a 10 times increase in capacity at half the cost. And while that's a bit of a stratospheric claim, it is probably true, given the people that I've spoken to who are saying this actually does work. Now, we've talked about different things of Viptela in the past, about high security and flexibility and reducing cost of ownership. But what I wanted to tell you is that we are going to be at Onug in New York. Viptela is sponsoring us, which means that we can afford to fly to New York to attend the Onug conference. And on May the 13th, that's the Wednesday evening at around about 7 p.m., we're going to be holding an event which is sponsored by Viptela, which is going to be a stage. We're going to have a bit of a stage set up with some network architects and infrastructure people from some household names. You'll know them, you know, big companies. We're still locking down the exact guests, but they're going to be names that you actually recognize. And they're going to be talking about, some of them have done SD-WAN with Viptela, and some of them are just talking about their experiences of working with redefining the WAN in the future. Now, the event is free, but you do have to register first. There's a link at viptela.com where you've just got to go along and give them your name, and you'll be able to come along. So if you are in the Open Networking User Group Conference in New York on May the 13th, we'd love to have you come and join Ethan and myself and talk a little bit about software-defined WAN. And if you can't make New York, we are recording the show, and we will be publishing it in the feed in sometime in the next few weeks. So thanks to Viptela for sponsoring us to go to New York and to cover this event, and thanks to them for bringing that content
to you. So Amazon results for AWS, some putting up some big numbers.
First time ever Amazon has declared AWS numbers as a separate line item, and there's a whole lot of people in the industry who on the edge of their seats to see what the real numbers for Amazon is, because everybody's been guessing it. So the worst people say it's not profitable and it must be being propped up by Amazon. Certain pundits were saying it's at least a $10 billion a year business. Both of those people are wrong. It is a $5 billion a year run rate, which is to say it's a $1.5 billion per quarter today, growing at 8 to 10%, which makes it nominally a $5 billion run rate, according to Cisco and EMC math. And profitable at around about 17%. So they're actually making an operating profit at 17% off $1.5 billion per quarter, which is pretty good.
That is pretty good.
Yeah. But A, not as big as everybody thought. So probably about half as big as what most people thought. And operating at a profit. A lot of people thought it was operating at a loss. I've always said it's been operating at a massive profit, which is exactly what it's doing. I never had any sense for how big it was, but I always knew it had to be operating at a profit, because the flip side of this is that AWS is sitting on $7 billion in assets, which is property, equipment, and accounts receivable. So if you figure all the land that they own for those data centers that they've built and the buildings that they've got and the servers and so forth, they've probably paid for all of that out of the operating cost of the business. So to turn a profit and have $7 billion in assets in less than 10 years is a very, very good business indeed. No two ways about it.
Yeah, very good business. Mm. I was surprised to see the number popped out to me, a 49.1% increase in revenue over a year ago. That is a big growth curve.
Yeah. If you had to grow at 50% per year, that's a tough thing to achieve when... But on the other hand, you're only building in one building. Let's say you are like Apple and you're growing at 50% per year. You've actually got to have a massive investment to build out pipelines and shipping, warehousing, manufacturing,
sure.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whereas AWS just has about 15 to 18 locations around the world. So they're making sure that it's really easy for themselves to grow by keeping it as simple as possible.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So it's not... And the thing is that, you know, Amazon's now operating at a scale where it's going to run into its own headwinds. I predict we're going to see much more, you know, they're going to have to work a lot harder and a lot smarter from here. They've got the easy scaling out of the way, the easy things to do, you know, like lots of computers in a data center. But as they get bigger and bigger, they're going to start to run into problems that are uniquely Amazon related.
Mm-hmm.
Remember I said...
Here's a question I've got about Amazon and AWS and a lot of these public cloud providers. Are they getting their funds from a small set of customers that are doing lots of big spends with them, or is it just spread out all over the market? When I hear about AWS, it's usually very small instances, not big operations. Not usually. I mean, some come to mind. I think Netflix is a big Amazon customer, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and Dropbox, and you know, there's various other signature customers that run around going, "We love Amazon because we'd run our business on them," and Amazon runs around telling everybody that, you know, all in. I was at the AWS summit in London last week. I think we talked about it a bit. And there's a lot of businesses who are all in with Amazon, you know, and they're spending all of their, what was it? One guy was saying he had to spend, was up for a $15 million refresh, US dollar refresh to build data centers. And now he's all in on Amazon. So if he's spending $5 million a year with Amazon or $3 million a year, whatever you want to call it, you know, that's real money.
Mm-hmm. That is real money. Yeah, and every startup that you talk to, when you ask them about their infrastructure build-out, it's all Amazon or in the cloud.
But that's because the people who fund them don't want to be left with a data center full of assets that they have to dispose of.
Yes, that's true.
It's much easier to go to a bunch of 25-year-old kids and say, mm-mm, time's up, dun, dun, turn it off. Take back the MacBooks. Give them their MacBooks and say, thank you very much. You know, and then... And the only thing you've got left is a building with some desks in it, you know? That's easy to get rid of in Silicon Valley.
A couple of foosball tables.
Yeah. So it's not so much that, you know, for venture capitalists, it makes perfect sense in terms of, it's not that it makes sense to be on Amazon, it's just it makes sense to be able to shut down businesses. It's a good business. No, I'm only joking. It does make sense for very small people to spend, you know, $10,000 buys you an awful lot of servers in Amazon for 6 months.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The trick is, as we've talked about on this show, is once you get beyond, you know, $200,000 a month, you're probably better off having your own data center today. It's significantly cheaper still because Amazon is really expensive. If, now there's some ifs here, as long as you don't want any of the fancy services that Amazon produces. If you want to use some of those, well, different story.
Are you saying it's the fancy services that cost you the money or just the basic packages?
Well, it's everything. Everything costs you money that happens in the cloud. But if you start using like Amazon's DynamoDB or their ML machine learning software or their, you know, their global DNS, the more and more of those services you use, the harder and harder it becomes to leave
yes.
Amazon's cloud, right?
Yep.
But the flip side of that is that you don't have to run a global DNS service. You don't have to go and buy a product that does global DNS. You don't have to buy a content delivery network separately. You just click a button on the Amazon dashboard and use the Amazon API and you're in business, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for every move that locks you further and further into Amazon, there's a benefit, as you might expect. Otherwise, people wouldn't have bought it.
That's right.
Yeah. And it's like there's a bunches of these services. Like there's an identity and authentication management system, which, you know, tracks and logs in every user. There's security review. You know, they log every access to the system. Well, if you build your own data center, you've got to build a logging system that logs everything that goes on in the infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
That costs money. It might be cheaper to rent it from Amazon, but you know it's more expensive over time. But maybe that's the right choice. Who knows?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's always that capital versus operating at the outset, and then you have to worry about being captured. But even if you build it yourself, there's issues of vendor lock-in, so there's always trade-offs.
Hmm. There is. But, you know,
all right.
Good for Amazon.
Yay, very good for Amazon. Doing well. Making billions out of pennies. That's pretty amazing. So some news, 30% of server storage and switches are now sold to clouds, speaking of Amazon.
Yeah, so this is the Register who basically took the reports that have been put out by a couple of different companies and pointed out that, and we've talked about this a few times, I think, on this show before, but IDC basically makes predictions about how much was sold in 2014 and who sold it. And in this particular one, they're looking at IT infrastructure revenue and pointing out that HP and Dell didn't do so well. In that they grew, but they didn't grow as much as Cisco and EMC, who did very well indeed, and growing. But in terms of numbers, Cisco and EMC didn't actually grow their top-line sales. They grew their profit margins. So they actually grew their revenue and their profit margins, but not actually the amount that was sold. But the flip side of this is that ODM Direct is $6.6 billion, which represents something like 30% of total server and networking sales to the market. So if you think, so for those of you who care, that means that, you know, the direct sales from the manufacturers in China to people like Amazon, Facebook, Google and so forth, is twice the size of HP's sales and three times the size of what Cisco sells in terms of, this is the entire infrastructure, network, servers, storage, right?
Uh-huh.
Three times of what size of what Cisco sells today, which there's two ways of looking at that. Either, you know, you could look at these results and say, wow, the big vendors have done great. They're all growing at 20% and that's awesome. And, you know, market share is all good and everything. Well, the other way of looking at it is, wow, they lost out on 30% of the market. Which way do you want to take it?
I guess it depends on which analyst you're asking.
Yeah. Yeah, is the cup half full or half empty or 50% over specification?
I mean, companies like to point to growth, you know, regardless of how they get there. So you can definitely spin these numbers any number of ways.
You sure can. The fact that Cisco and EMC are growing profit margins says they're charging more for the same products fundamentally at some level. And that would suggest that there are, you know, companies out there who like to buy from those, from the established players, and they're happy with that and they're willing to pay more for it would be the sort of the implication, I think.
Sure. Maybe they're charging more, but maybe they're also finding efficiencies in other ways too, that you don't just have to raise prices to grow your profit margin.
Well, you know, after 10 years of efficiency drives, I find that a little hard to believe.
Mm-hmm. It's possible.
It doesn't seem to make sense. Cisco and EMC have been cutting headcounts and focusing on core businesses, seems like every 6 months for the last 5 years?
Yeah, that's true.
So I'm not sure that it's that. I think they're charging more for the same stuff. Good for them. Good for their shareholders.
Good for their shareholders. I mean, if you can get away with it.
Yep. And their customers must think there's value in that. Otherwise, they wouldn't spend it.
Yes. That's capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Ethan, any comments?
Well, I have a very bad cough and I've been on mute. I apologize. I've had a hard time keeping the cough down, so I've just been quiet and in the background.
Oh, good. You're going to bring that to interrupt.
I am. Spread the disease.
Fantastic.
Just what we need.
Talking about IDC, they've got data center predictions for 2015.
Yeah, this is in the same vein. It seems to be a prediction-o-matic show this week, which is loosely related to the first one. Again, I'm trying not to dominate the conversation, so please do pipe in, both of you. But this is, again, saying that the vast majority of IT assets are being shipped to the cloud and not to enterprise or service providers. And, in fact, you know, comments like, 65% of organizations will target creation and expansion of third platform systems rather than maintaining existing systems of record. In other words, whatever they've got in their data center isn't necessarily going to build new systems to replace them, the majority of people. You know, immature asset management practices will prevent organizations from converging. In other words, they're not going to build clouds because they've got legacy processes to ask, you know, if you've got assets sitting on the books with 5 to 10 year depreciation schedules, you can't cloudify. You've got to get rid of those assets. And that's just going to take time.
Uh-huh. And so there's a whole bunch of it. I know that point that you're talking about because I dug into this article quite a bit. You know, they say incompatible or immature IT asset management practices. In other words, guys, you're doing it wrong. You're not moving quickly enough. You're not changing your internal operations quickly enough. And you're not, as you just pointed out, Greg, maybe depreciating your assets quickly enough to be able to handle modern data center techniques. And right, they said converged and they said software defined, as in the way you do IT is changing and the silos are getting broken down and all of this is tightly coupled together. So if you're not moving towards that, you're just going to say, you know, maybe the cloud guys can do that because that is the world that they live in. There were other things that were interesting in this piece too. One of them was fascinating to me. It says by 2016, they're predicting hyperscale data centers will house more than 50% of raw compute capacity and 70% of raw storage capacity worldwide, becoming the primary consumers and adopters of new compute and storage technologies. not your business anymore. which is, you know, if you're a technologist, you want to look at it from that perspective for a moment. That's sort of depressing because all the horsepower seems to be heading, you know, outside of the company that you work for. They're probably going to be looking to someone else to house that stuff someday. You know, hyperscale meaning the people we talk about a network break a lot, you know, Microsoft and Google and Amazon and, you know, and those guys that are doing stuff really big, but also large business operations, eBay or big financial service operations, you know, anybody that's got to crunch a lot of data and serve a lot of customers probably has a business reason that they're doing hyperscale. Is your business that? And if it isn't, is your business able to keep doing compute in a way that is cost effective when compared to migrating your compute out to the cloud? And if the answer is no, then at some point your business is going to catch on and go, man, we outsource this stuff to the cloud. We move this compute to the cloud and shut down the data center. It's cheaper for us. Well, what's that mean for you if you're a technologist is the question. Because, you know, if you're like a network engineer, it doesn't mean the whole network's going away, but it might mean the data center network begins to become less important to the business over time. But I mean, the whole you know, big point of this article was just how much data processing is moving out to these big, you could think of them as centralized in a way, data centers, rather than everybody's got their own and they're doing it all
in
house.
So do you think they're moving out? Do you actually think things are moving out? Or do you think, what I think more is happening is we have our enterprise data centers and they're doing their stuff, right? But there's other stuff happening that the cloud is being used for, like WhatsApp and Dropbox and Netflix. Those are new businesses that cloud enables. I don't think... Do you know what I'm saying? It's so, not all about...
I know what you're saying, but I think the deal is, to me, that at some point it becomes cost-effective and to migrate your stuff over to the cloud. Maybe we're getting to that tipping point where that's happening. Because you made the point earlier talking about Amazon. Running compute on Amazon is pricey. There's a per-hour cost, and it's not cheap. So it's not like you're just going to want to, you know, up and migrate your virtual machines that are running your Microsoft Exchange off to Amazon because it's cheaper and better, and woo, it's not that simple. It's a more complicated cost equation. But as costs continue to come down, at some point it's going to be more expensive to run your data center with all the cooling and the power. And so why would you keep doing that and not migrate to cloud at some point? And that, to me, it's a question of tipping point. So as far as today, yeah, people are doing more specific applications. It's Salesforce and it's whatever it is that that they're taking advantage of. And that's driving up a lot of cloud utilization. That's where the compute is going to. But I do think enterprises are going to eventually start shutting down some of their operations because it won't make sense to keep them around anymore. Here's another one of the stats from the article. It says, their predictions, you know, in the next 2 years, 25% of all large and mid-sized businesses will confront significant power cooling facility mismatches with new IT systems, limiting them to using less than 75% of their physical data center space. Hey, we got all this square footage, but we can't actually fill the thing because we can't cool it and we can't get enough power to it. Well,
that's
why would
feature.
That be?
That's not a bug. What? I don't know about you.
But it speaks
having
to the
spent
fact
20
that,
years worried about we don't have enough space, but we've got plenty of power and cooling. Why are we shedding? You know, that's a success. That's, you know, yay, we won. That's not.
No, I mean, yeah, so seriously, my take on that is it means all of a sudden we're just not as efficient as we ought to be. I look at modern servers and modern switches as being power conscious, and older stuff as being, for the amount of rack units that the older systems take up, not as power efficient and certainly not as cooling efficient. And so I'm imagining here that part of the problem is we got places that are running old gear with old applications. They're not getting migrated, and they're not getting the job done with on the efficiency side of things. So the old apps are kicking around, the old equipment is kicking around, they're trying to add new stuff, and now they can't because they're maxed out. Yeah. At some point, it just, again, it's going to make sense just to migrate this stuff away to public cloud. I don't know how you do that cost model. I don't know how you do that ROI. And maybe it's not there yet, but I really think it's coming.
Yeah, I don't know if I say that I see a migration. I think you're going to have a bunch of, let's call them legacy applications that sit inside the data center for a variety of reasons. But new stuff, it's going to be rare that you're building it to run inside your data center. A business unit, a small group inside the organization is going to say, we can do this on the cloud. I don't have to send a ticket to IT. I don't have to wait, you know, even a week to get this up and running. Developers are going to be running off doing stuff like that. So new initiatives, new business needs, that's going to happen in the cloud, while the data center is, you know, your financial system, other core systems that just stay and sort of run the way they always have. I don't know that.
Well, I'm nodding my head, you know, in agreement for a lot of that, because yes, there are going to be certain applications that, for whatever the reasons are, fill in the blank, security, or it's just a weird application, whatever it is, it doesn't match very well with running on public cloud. And so there's going to be those sorts of issues there. That are going to, it's just going to make maybe more sense in isolated cases to keep certain apps in-house. But what if we solve the security problem, which seems to be one of the big issues there? And I know there was a point here IDC made about security. Let me find it in the list. Yes, by 2016, the top 20 providers of consumer and business as a service solutions will deploy broad spectrum multi-data center security solutions. So will that help with some of the objections that we have today to migrating stuff to public cloud? It might, if the security problem is truly effectively answered.
I don't think the security problem will ever be truly effectively answered, so no.
Wow, that was dark cynicism coming from Drew. Wow.
No, I think it's not dark cynicism. I think it's very practical. I could go on at length about this. The security problem is not going to be solved. Security is a perpetual bugaboo. I think people are, I think people have a sense of where the risks are with cloud and what they can get away with putting in there. The security fears, I think, are there, but I don't think they're as serious as they used to be. But just because a cloud provider says, hey, we've got all these neat security services, doesn't mean the security problem is going to be solved.
I think there's startups in the security industry that are going,
Oh, absolutely. Of course. Yeah. That's how startups get started, because they think they can do it better.
I think that, I mean, the thing that's clear is that if you move your assets into the cloud, you don't need firewalls, or you don't need hardware firewalls. Maybe you don't need virtual firewalls. But what actually happens is, just like everything else in the cloud, everything gets much harder. Because now you actually have to do application security. You can't, because you're no longer spending time fiddling with IDSs and firewalls and, you know, identifying everybody who comes into the data center and logging their accesses in and out of your cage and, you know, all that sort of stuff. The only thing in security that you've got left to do is application security. And that means logs, capturing logs and log analysis and verifying that your applications are actually secure. And that's what happens in the cloud, is that your security just gets exponentially harder, in the same way that your networking gets exponentially harder. You're no longer just configuring VLANs, you're configuring VPCs in Amazon's AWS, or you're creating container workloads that dynamically adapt, move around. So how do you do IP address management, and how do you track traffic flows? How do you monitor that your application is performing at 1 milli, you know, delivering access, delivering response time to customers of 50 milliseconds? Is it the network or is it the application? How do you validate these things? Everything in the cloud gets harder, not easier.
Because we're abstracted away from the actual
right
physical devices that are running things. So sure, but to me, these just seem like the same problems we have in the data center. It's just removed a layer, and so it shouldn't be terribly hard to do some adaptation for that. But it's a fair point to make that for some businesses, that's going to make it harder for them to make that leap, because they're going to need all these things resolved before they're willing to make the jump. I just don't see it as an insurmountable problem. I just see it as something that's going to happen over time.
It's the same thing, you know, like 15 years ago, we were installing AppleTalk and IPX networks. And now it's IP. That's fine. Next year it'll be IPv6. Well, in the next decade, maybe. But anyway. So did anybody track the RSA conference this week?
The only thing I tracked was that our friend Beaker had a little glitch on his keynote presentation.
Yeah, excellent. Let's move on. Nobody cares. Clearly nobody cares about what happened at the RSA conference, and neither do I. I couldn't find anything of interest. I mean, the RSA conference is supposedly a security conference, but it always seems to be corporate security, which means it's fairly much trimming your toenails and checking out belly button fluff. RSA is not about doing real security. It's about doing the security that you think you want to do. So moving on.
Oh, you call me dark and cynical?
Well, that's par for the course with Pharaoh. Coming from you, it was like, interesting. Wow, Drew. Hey, where's that coming from?
It'd be boring if I sat there and was like Drew or the whole show, wouldn't it?
So I'm cynical, dark, and boring. All right. I think I got to reevaluate this relationship
here. That's a character profile there for a book somewhere.
All right. So just quickly, if I can ask you guys, I'm curious, how long do you think this explosive cloud growth can go on? How long can the cloud providers keep boosting the market here with all the gear they're buying? How long is this going to go on before they plateau?
It's funny. I was reflecting on this before the show because as I was thinking through the IDC predictions and about all the growth and then the AWS article, it's like, well, you know how in life you buy gadgets and at some point you have enough gadgets and you kind of realize, hey, I've got enough stuff. It does everything I need to do. I don't need to keep buying crap. Right. You know, at what point do the cloud guys run into that point? It's like, hey, this infrastructure is actually enough. I don't need to keep doing stuff because I can handle everything. And I think the answer comes back to the continued explosive data rate thing, you know, that we keep hearing about. How much data are we pumping over the internet? And the answer is a lot. You know, how many new startups with interesting new applications to run on your smartphone are out there? You know, a lot. Every day there's someone else turning on something else, and there's some new surge in traffic. Video streaming from the Netflix people and so on. That's all a big thing. And then I hate to say it because it makes me throw up my mouth a little, but Internet of Things. If it is actually a thing that where we're running a lot of sensors and whatever else to put yet more of a data load on the network and something that's got to process that data and do something with it, I don't think it's short term. I maybe the growth tapers a bit, but I don't see it falling off or plateauing anytime soon. What do you think, Pharaoh?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you that I think there's at least another decade of growth in there. And I think the bulk of the growth will be new businesses, not existing businesses, moving into the cloud. Because to make use of Google or Amazon-style clouds, you have to rewrite your applications or get new applications. And that requires a decade of change. That's not something that's going to happen. And I don't think we'll really start to see, incumbent industries who've got money. And, you've got to remember that a lot of banks don't need to be on Amazon because they've got plenty of money. They're making plenty of profits. They don't need to save money by being in the cloud. And they don't want the hassle of moving to the cloud either. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Why go through all that pain of transforming something that's working just fine? I got plenty of money. I'm in a profitable market. I'll stick with it. So I think, but we're going to see much more new stuff, Apple Watches, fitness apps, recipes, online recipes, websites, ever more niche because it's so much easier to do website hosting than it ever was before. To build a global, building global services that only exist in virtual environments. And these may well be $500 million, billion-dollar opportunities like WhatsApp or YouTube or whatever. And they're all enabled by these cloud technologies. But, when you go into your bank and swipe your cash card, it won't be on Amazon's cloud, at least for another decade, because it's going to take at least that long for that transition to happen.
Mm-hmm. It's funny what you say about those little apps that are out there in the cloud. I have a Garmin GPS watch that I use for fitness tracking. You can run with the thing, and it collects all this data about your run or go hiking or whatever, and it's a useful store of data for people that are monitoring their athletic performance. And if you're curious, I have none. I just changed the battery in this thing and had to go through a process to do that. And so I reacquainted myself with all the Garmin stuff. There's a whole app in the cloud for this thing. You plug it in, it uploads your data. It used to be to a local app on your machine. No, now it's in the cloud. And you can share with other people and find groups in your area to people to go running with and this kind of thing. Stuff like that's popping up all over the place. It's, you don't even realize it. There's some little micro niche that's got a reason to have an application in the cloud.
Yeah, my wife has a Fitbit, and she's doing sort of like a running competition with a woman in England. because they're doing it all online on their smartphones. All right, so more growth, and this kind of fits in this next story, lower pricing coming for network silicon.
This is very, very on the inside of the industry. Most of the manufacturing of silicon for networking has been done by a company called TSMC, or Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation. And they've been specializing in the manufacturing of very high-end silicon. So anybody who's making really modern chips have been doing it with TSMC for the last 20 years or so, because they've been investing in the fabs, right? That make the wafers, that make the very... And they are the only ones making 14 nanometer chips, and you had to book your capacity and they would and so forth and so on. But recently, Samsung has caught up in 14 nanometer fabrication, and networking silicon is moving from 40 nanometer to 20 nanometer processors. So if TSMC is getting some competition from Samsung, then there's more capacity in TSMC, there'll be competitive pressures, and then the prices were starting to come down. And so that means that hopefully we could see a lowering in pricing around silicon, not just merchant silicon, although that's the obvious piece, but vendor silicon itself. That could mean for the vendors, while they may not necessarily discount, they may get more profits to give their shareholders, and then, which is what they always want to be able to do. Mm-hmm. So,
all right,
that's what it says. So, you know, TSMC has had a monopoly and have been, you know, able to charge on high quality silicon, on high density silicon. But hey, yeah.
That's capitalism.
Welcome to it. Yes.
All right. I think that brings us to the end of another network break.
Hey, I just wanted to quickly talk about the Nokia Alcatel-Lucent deal.
Oh, yeah, sure. This is a story I popped in. Nokia and Alcatel did the deed.
Yeah, well, there's two things there. One is, you know, what is the secret sauce that is happening there? And also the fact that John Chambers threw out that it was White Box that was forcing this to happen. And I was thinking about, why would White Box, because neither of these two companies do Ethernet switches, right? Alcatel-Lucent sold their enterprise switching division, now called ALA, or Alcatel-Lucent Enterprise, to a Chinese venture capitalist firm, mm-hmm. and it's now a separate business in its own right. So why is White Box, and I think what he's actually referring to is White Box servers running the software that runs in the RAN. So in your radio access network, so what Alcatel and Alcatel-Lucent and Nokia have is businesses providing 3G, 4G appliances. So the radio things go into the towers, and then all of the hardware appliances that run the software that run the wireless networks that connect to your smartphone. Mm-hmm. And of course, all that software is turning into NFV and software, which changes their business models, because if you can't sell the hardware, which is what NFV is, you've only got VMs. And that changes your business model, because if your hardware is, I don't know, 50% of your revenue, and suddenly that goes away, you're in, you've got a massive change. So, you know, if you're Nokia and you've been selling those IPSO boxes, which used to be the hardware underneath the checkpoint firewall, but they used to use them for their RANs, you know, the diameters and all that sort of stuff. And it you know, if those hardware appliances just turn into generic x86 boxes, Nokia's got a real change in its business model. 50% of its revenue could disappear overnight, and their software now has to be NFV ready. That's the challenge, I think. And when he says White Box, it's not White Box Ethernet, it's White Box servers taking mm-hmm. away their business.
That makes sense. So you can't sell a high-end appliance anymore. You've got to try to find a way to sell a service, a virtualized service.
Yeah. So this is where, you know, people like Bluecoat with their proxy servers, and Riverbed with its WAN acceleration, WAN compression, you know, stuff, you know, Silverpeak with WAN compression, or even companies like Palo Alto and F5 with, you know, application firewalls and so forth. If you look at what they talk about in their share to their shareholders, they're saying, and the investors are saying, well, what's your ratio? What's your transfer ratio to virtual appliances? Because virtual appliances should be cheaper than hardware appliances, because the software on the hardware appliances, it should get cheaper with just software. There should be a reduction in revenue overall.
Yes.
And investors are worried about what, in fact, that might have on the share price, because customers, well, you know, if you're not selling the hardware, customers might not pay quite so much for it. So that's the risk to their business models. And, of course, hardware has a lot of service revenue attached to it.
Absolutely.
Mm. Yeah. And a lot of costs, too, by the way.
I don't know, though. I mean, yeah, Oracle has demonstrated that you can do good business selling software, so that there are ways to still stick it to your customer.
Sure. And Amazon has shown that you actually don't need Oracle to make a good business out of not buying Oracle software. Which is, I think, more of a trend for the future, is open source is showing the way for a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, we can talk about that in our next episode, maybe.
For sure.
We're hitting our 30-minute time limit, and we don't want to stress our listeners' ears too much.
No, we definitely don't. We love our listeners' ears.
We'll whisper sweet nothing.
I'll strike them. Strike them through the microphone. Does that feel better, dear listener?
All right, it's getting gross now. We better stop. All right, so, Greg, where can folks find you?
You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com and on the Twitter is at etherealmind. Love to see you there sometime.
And Ethan?
EthanCBanks.com is my blog, and at ECBanks is my Twitter handle.
All right, and we're recording this the Friday before Interop, so if you happen to be joining us in Las Vegas, please come up and say hi. Let us know if there's anything you want us to talk about on the show. And you can find me on Twitter at interop_Andrew. And I think that's it.
Cool.